Have you ever considered buying a commercial property without a tenant? Hi, I'm Jared Krause. I'm the co-host of the Property Powers Australia podcast with Sam Powell. And myself, Sam, and I chat to Steve Polizzi, who is the founder of the buyer's agency firm Polizzi Property, where they've bought over 1,000 properties for clients. And he's also the author of the book Commercial Property Explained Simply. And in this pod, us three talk about the pros and cons of buying commercial property with tenants. We also talk about the pros and cons of buying commercial property without tenants and the nuances of doing both and the fluctuations. We also discuss what type of asset or location would be best suited to property with no tenants and what your goals are, and then what would be best suited to buying a property with tenants already in place for the type of goals that you may have in your commercial property investments. We also talk about what a good tenant agreement looks like versus one that may not be so good. And then we talk about the different variations of those depending on your goals as well. And lastly, Steve explains a rent vesting strategy for businesses in commercial property and when it's worth it for you as a business owner, when it's not worth it for you as a business owner, and the risks involved in on both sides. Now, there's so much value in this pod. We're just going to dive straight on in. Enjoy.
Welcome to Property Pals, the podcast where we share everything around how to build a property portfolio, from researching areas, financing, structuring, buying, selling, and reinvesting to live a life of financial independence. As a disclaimer, any information shared by myself, Jared, Sam, and the Property Pals team is strictly general and should not be taken as constituting professional advice. You should consider seeking independent legal, financial, and taxation advice from a qualified professional.
Welcome back, Steve. Thanks for coming on the pod.
No, thanks for having me on, guys. Cool. We can't leave too long between each chats like we have this time.
It's been ages. It's been so long. No, everybody that is listening, thanks for coming on. And last time we chatted about asset selection with you, Steve. And before that, we talked about choosing the location. So if you want to know how to choose the location, how to choose the right asset, make sure you watch the or listen to the last two episodes. Now we're going to be talking about buying a commercial property with a tenant or without a tenant and the pros and cons. So I guess let's go through the pros and cons of having tenants first, Steve.
Yep. Okay. So the biggest one is you obviously know what return you're getting from the get-go. So you can calculate what the cash flow is with that return. The other biggest one, and we'll probably touch on this with the vacant properties, is finance is generally easier because you've got servicing. It's not like residential where they click doing like a rental appraisal and they go, oh, this is what rent's for, and they take that into account. They won't actually take it into account. There's a couple third-tier lenders that might, but most of the banks won't actually touch it. So unless you've got servicing for the whole debt, you're not going to actually be able to buy something at the same size. So that's the main one of the tenanted is a bit of security that you know what cash flow you're getting from the get-go with no vacancy, and borrowing is actually easier. And you've got more options for borrowing. So because you've got the stock standard 15, 20, 25-year loans, you've got all those full doc options. You've actually got a thing called a lease stock option. So that's a loan based on the strength of the lease. So you have a bit of a lower LVR with it. But if you get something with a five-year lease, they'll give you a five-year loan based on that. So where you might have servicing issues, you can actually still buy with commercial, which is probably one of the big advantages of commercial is you can keep pushing your portfolio quite far, whereas residential, most people cap out at 5 to 10 times their income.
I got a bit of a question just before you jump into the next pros and cons, but is there somewhat of a strategy? Like, what if you found the tenant first and you could sign like a lease agreement? Would the banks look at that? And all you had to do was match that sort of tenant into a vacant property? Is that somewhat of a strategy?
Yep, you can do that, but it's the hard thing is actually timing of it. Because typically if the property's for sale and a selling agent or a property manager's got the tenant, they'll probably offer it as part of the sale. So that way they get the best of both worlds. They can actually try to play off the owner occupiers with the people with the tenant. Stuff like that does happen, but for every day, I see it because like I said, we're reviewing hundreds of properties every week. Most people aren't going to come across like that. We might talk about this later, whereas if you have a business or you know someone with a business who's looking for a spot, buying that premise, knowing that you can put them into it and then you get a win-win out of that. But then again, like I said, we'll probably go over there's pros and cons of vacant premises as well.
Yeah, we'll jump in. What are the other pros and cons of the tenants then?
The cons are probably you're locked in with that tenant for the lease period. So if you see some opportunity down the track, so say the rent might be capped at 2% rental increases. And what we've seen in the, it used to be the opposite. People used to love 3-5% rental increases. Now we actually want it to be CPI because we're at like 7%. So you kind of lose out on cash flow for that period because you're locked into who that tenant is. If they're a bit of a pain in the bum tenant as well, it's kind of hard to get rid of them unless they've actually done something outside of the lease. So you're a bit more locked into who the tenant is as well. Same thing is you can't do value add opportunities if they're there as well, unless they're okay with it. So say I buy a warehouse and it doesn't have a mezzanine floor and I want to build one because I get more square meter rates because of it. While the tenant's there, you can't do it. So because if they say no, like there's no obligation, you can kick them out and do it. So there's probably a more locked in nature of that.
No, that's a good con. Because a pro from the tenant side of things, I would think as well is that the business analysis. Like, do you go pretty in depth into understanding the business of that tenant when you're looking at buying?
Yeah, good question. So yep, every single time we do business analysis. We do competition analysis. So we actually look at who their competitor is and what's popping up. And we mentioned on the last podcast, like the risk of like a new tenant opening up nearby or shopping center competing with that. So you do that as well. Then we even talk to the tenant. So we actually interview them for about half an hour to find out like, how's business going? Are they going to stay on? Who the competitors are they worried about? Like what are the issues with the complex that they're currently like? You find out, I think, and the cool thing is they actually tell you all the negatives because they never actually want to present everything in a perfect light. They're never going to be like, oh, guess what, Sam and Jared? We're making bucket loads of money. We can handle any rental increases you've got. They're normally the opposite. So they actually tell you all the stuff that the agent's not telling you. So you can get some quite valid information out of them there. But you definitely need to do that competition analysis. Most critical probably on retail because that's where the value is in who the tenant you're buying. Slightly less for industrial if you're getting something with shorter leases. Obviously, if you're buying like a Bunnings or we're under contract on a Pet Barn at the moment, that's like a 7-year lease. So that's very important who they are. We don't want to lose them because that's the whole value of what we're paying for. You definitely need to analyze that. We even pay for ourselves for a credit history check on the tenant just to see if they've ever defaulted or liquidated because that will kind of look at their risk profile as well.
Going on that Pet Barn one, just like... Say 7 years time, do you, like obviously it's crystal balling kind of stuff, but is there strategies that you discuss with your buyers saying like if they do vacate, you know, expect, you know, 12 months vacancy, or you could, you know, do a strata tiling kind of thing where you could sort of build in interior walls, or do you run down that process?
Yeah, definitely. So we look at that. The pro and the con with those, they're normally somewhat versatile because they are generally just a big warehouse. They're painted yellow and they've got the Pet Barn. So they do have some options down the track. The benefit is the guarantee on the lease is backed by the franchise. So it's probably one of the strongest one. You'll still do some Googling and some research on like Pet Barn as a whole, because obviously if they're going down the toilet, that means nothing because they might close up shop. But the actual risk we do is we look at what amount of debt we're going to have left on that property if they do leave. For that exact reason, Sam, the vacancies on a big premise isn't going to be 1 or 2 months, probably going to be a couple years top. So, and part of the risk mitigation is we worked out on a 70% LVR on this one. It's on the outskirts of Canberra, just for information. It'll actually have about a 30% debt on it at the end of the 7 years. So, and then basically we just went to our client and said, look, can you handle 30% debt interest rates with no tenant? And we looked at the numbers and they said, yeah, that's fine. Like, cool. This is a pretty low risk one then for 7 years. Even lower risk if they sign the next option and go another 7 years, and then you've got 15 years out and you'll be debt free and you can mitigate the risk completely.
Yeah, no, I like that. So
I love that, Hugh. I love it a lot. I want to jump in and ask about, you know, Sam's question was really good around like, what will you at the end of a 7-year term in terms of like strata titling or vacancy? But I have heard it being talked about where people will buy commercial property knowing that the tenant is going to finish up soon, and then you'll do market analysis based on what rate you could get, and it could be a superior rate. So is that why you see there's pros to buying without tenants, or a tenant nearly leaving the or finishing their lease? Like, so we should we go through the pros and cons of no tenants, or is there more to talk about with tenants?
Yeah, so when there is a tenant, whether they've got one and they're going to leave anyway, even if they were on options, so say they're on like 3x3x3, you still do a market analysis on rent at every option. So if the rent's gone up by 30%, you push it up 30%. So it's not really the value there. The main value is if you think you're getting a better buy because they are going to leave, and that puts off investors because it wipes out all the lease stock people. And some people just have a fear. They're just like, I don't want to buy a property that's going to be vacant in 8 months, for instance. Mm-hmm. Banks as well typically won't look at the rent if it's less than 18 months as well. So you want 18 months left on the lease for the banks to look highly upon it. So finance is actually going to be a bit harder if it's a shorter one. Where it's probably critical, like besides the buying well, because you might get it 5 or 10% below market value because there's less buyers in it, is if you see value add opportunity. So like the example I used before, they're going to move out, I can put a mezzanine area in or subdivide the tenancies, then you're doing a value add strategy where that means you get shorter uplift, which means you can progress your portfolio quicker. Because if they were there for 5 years, you could do nothing. Whereas if I can fabricate 20, 30% extra capital growth out of it, cool, I get to go buy another one within a couple of years.
You just need the cash to do it, to do the building, just, right?
Yeah, but again, it just depends what you want. Like a mezzanine you can build for around $80,000. So, and you'll generally get probably a 20% uplift depending on the portion size.
Everyone would just say,
oh, why doesn't everyone do that? It's hard to get the right price and buy it well and time the tenants right and do all that type of stuff. But it's the same thing as you can buy and, I don't know, renovate a residential property or put a granny flat on and get some kind of equity that way.
What would be the, like, I know it's going to be it's sucking it in, like, it depends answer, but the council approvals for these mezzanines, or say if you go in strata title, like, is that mm-hmm. 80 grand that you mentioned, is that inclusive of you getting that council approval for that mezzanine?
So council, again, this is just for ballpark numbers where most investors lie. So sub $3 million, depends on the size, obviously. It's about 10 to 12 grand for the approval. So by the time you get all the engineering stuff, then the fabrication is anywhere kind of 60, 70 grand-ish, because it's just some beams effectively and the floor. Offices, if you're building an office space, that's a bit more expensive because you've got a bit more fit out and air conditioning and stuff like that. So it does depend, but it's case by case. You just assess it on its own merits and kind of go from there. It's always a nice to have. Like if you know there's an option there, I can put a mezzanine area. The big one, here's a little trick for people, is the big one that stops most people is they buy it thinking they're going to be okay. It's car parks that actually council push back on. So if you build too much area and you don't have the extra car spots, they'll actually say no. And again, as you mentioned on previous ones, talk to town planners because they're going to do some checks for you.
Yeah, no, that's very, very good points. Well, let's jump into what are the pros and cons of the no tenants then? Like, when would you go for a no tenant property?
Yeah, okay. So there's two aspects of this. One's obviously if you're a business owner and you're going to move in the spot. And then the other one is if you're an investor trying to buy the vacant one. So I'll start with the pros. Pros, as we sort of alluded to before, you can do value add opportunities right away. The other one is you might save on the actual purchase price because it is vacant. You'll be able to get a little bit cheaper. In some markets, we've spoken before, Sam, about like some markets is the opposite. There's more owner occupiers looking for space than there are investors. So you get a premium price for having it vacant. So that's another advantage, is if you're going to sell or buy one, you can look at that as well. But the value add is probably the biggest one for me for the investor side. We'll touch on the owner occupier one a bit after. The negatives with it is finance is bloody tough because there's no rent. The banks aren't going to lend to you. And here's the big one that most people forget about. You have to pay GST on the purchase price. So you do get that GST back though. So if you've got like on your first BAS statement, you can get it back if it is an investment. But because you can't get a high LVR because there's no rent, so most people are going to have to get like a 60% LVR or 50% LVR plus 10%. On $1 million purchase, you're talking like 450 to 600 grand, like acquisition costs. So there's a lot more skin in the game. Whereas a typical like $1 million warehouse on an 80% LVR is $250,000. So there's sometimes twice as much capital that you have to put in, which is a risk itself. Putting in that much capital into one asset, all your eggs in one basket there. So that's probably the biggest negative, I'd say, is servicing and the GST and the acquisition cost for it. But the benefit is more value-add opportunities, more things you can effectively do with it.
Just side question, a $1 million warehouse with 80% LVR, is that pretty common?
They're not pretty common. There's typically about four lenders doing it at the moment. So at the moment, yep. I'm seeing ANZ, Suncorp, Liberty, and BOQ are offering 80%. Rest of the other ones are about 70%, 65% LVRs. But there's also lenders doing 100% loans for business owners. So you can go out if you're a business owner and get 100% loan. That's got risk with it. But the whole premise of that is most banks know that business owners aren't paying themselves a huge salary, or they don't have a big lump sum of funds sitting there because they keep it in the business because they don't want to pay tax on it yet. So they know if there's value in the business and they can service in that, they'll give them that loan. It's got its own risk, though. Obviously, going 100% LVR on anything, you are more susceptible to all the fluctuations.
We do have interest rate differentials as well with the, because it's in the bank size, right? Higher risk with less deposits, or is it kind of similar?
It generally follows the kind of residential one. So higher LVRs, higher interest rates. And if you go to second tiers, it's even higher. Self-managed super funds are even higher. We're talking like 7.5% to 8.5% because there's not many lenders doing it. But I always tell people, you shouldn't be making your decision on the investment based on what different banks are offering. Like, are you planning to own this for 1 year or are you planning to own this for 15 years? And even when people go, oh, look, I'm paying a 7% interest rate. I'm like, cool. When I bought my portfolio 12 years ago, I was looking at 7% interest rates because the 30-year average was like 5 or 6%. So I had that buffer already there. And that's what I find when people go, oh, I'm going to wait for the interest rates to come down before I buy. And I'm like, well, how long are you holding this thing for?
Yeah. And if you wait for the interest rates to come down before you buy, you may be missing out on a bit of an opportunity there. We talked about like the unicorn property too. But I want to come back to the no tenants and purchasing with no tenants. Is there a type of asset, like, or is there like maybe two types of assets you would rather go for that have tenants, and then two that you would rather go for that don't have tenants in terms of like the type of asset?
Yeah, so the one we'll probably disregard is office space because that's a bit of an easy decision. You're either buying that, like there's not much value add you can do. Like if it's in a high density or medium density, it's a bit of concrete in the sky. Yeah, you can furbish it up a little bit, but that's more to do if you want to have your business there or you already want a tenant because you want the cash flow from it anyway. So we'll kind of disregard that. The industrial and retail change on what you're kind of buying there. So like retail, buying a vacant one and getting a new like blue chip tenant can actually increase the value. So you can actually, I'm going to say gamble is probably the wrong word. Like if you buy something being like, this would be perfect for a medical tenant and you kind of prep it to get ready for like a new lease or get the property manager to get a medical tenant in there, that sells at a different cap rate to say a cafe. So you can actually get some uplift there. So retail gives you options there. If you're buying a freestanding retail, you've got all the value add that a resi has as well. You can like paint the outside of the building and do all that type of stuff. Funny enough, I mentioned in the last podcast, I've got a cafe in Ipswich. My tenant actually renovated my whole property for me for free. He was just like, oh, it's a bit tight and old. Do you mind if I renovate it? And he completely like rendered the outside of the building, painted it, freshened up all the inside because it's for his business. And he even asked me, and I'm like, of course he can. As soon as he did it, went back to the banks and revalued and pulled out some equity.
Excellent.
You didn't increase his rent, did you?
No. So that was actually part of it. I'm not going to increase his rent for 3 years because of it. And in regards to that, it didn't actually change much. You work it out like on a 3% increase on, I think I'm getting $38,000 a year. Like it's not much considering he spent, I can't remember what he spent, 60, 80 grand, 100 grand or whatever it is. Me losing out on a few grand a year is probably not critical. But to answer your question, industrial is a bit of a different one because retail, they're very fixated on that area. Like they have to be in that strip. That's where they want. That's the whole success of the business is based on where they buy.
Based on
foot traffic or just generally where they want to open up an area. Like where like the medical wants to have their thing, like where they want to actually own. Like that's so much more important for the area. Yeah, for like an industrial though, they don't care. They just want to be in like the general, there's a normally perimeter. They normally come in and say, oh, look, there's a 5 kilometer perimeter. This is where we want to be. And then there's lots of options. So it's about finding the run with the right size that kind of fits their needs. So a little bit more versatility and options there. But then you've also got options if you're buying freestanding, like we said before, splitting tenancies and adding things to it. You can add solar panels to the roof. I've had people put telecommunications on and get like offers from like Vodafone and Telstra and things like that. So there's some options there as well. And I think that sort of answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. I like it. So tenant agreements as well. What's a good tenant agreement versus a bad tenant agreement? That's a very general question that I'm sure we'll sort of like narrow it down to a few things of like pros and cons of what a good tenant agreement looks like.
Either way, you need to look at what your net return is. So some leases, not many, even probably about 20% are gross leases where you're responsible for the outgoings. So you pay the council rates, the water rates and all that. So you work out your net return after paying that. The risk is you're susceptible to them increasing. So when council increase their rates, unless the rent's going up in proportion to what you actually start losing, your increases there. But again, the biggest one I generally focus on is sometimes security. So because if you get in a long lease, what bank guarantees and personal guarantees do they have for that? Because if there is none, it means nothing. You've got like a month bond, and if they decide to leave, well, if they dissolve a company, what are you going to do? You're not going to take a company that's got no money to court. So that's where the guarantee is important. So as always, talk to your solicitor. Your solicitor is the one who should kind of go over everything. But I look at the net return, who pays the outgoings, who's responsible for what, the make good clause, and the guarantees on the lease are the big main ones.
With insurance on those commercial properties too, do they have those like rental guarantees and things like that? With the insurance, so they like in residential, obviously you can have those rental arrears insurance where they pay you if the tenant sort of defaults. Is that the same with commercial or not?
Yep, you can still get them. A lot of people don't because it's quite expensive. Because like an insurance company being like, oh yeah, we'll back that they stop paying rent, so it's a bit more expensive. It depends. You can get stuff for like if there's like acts of nature, for instance. So like while they're not operating, not paying rent, if there's a flood or a cyclone or whatever it may be, you can kind of get that. You can get full protection as well, but it, for me, it's not worthwhile. Different ones will have different aspects. So you can just get like a lot of times like the shop front, like if the window gets broken or graffiti, you can get insurances for that if the tenant has it. One of the things probably worth pointing out though is you need to make sure your tenant has the adequate insurances as well. That's probably a bigger risk. So like public indemnity and building insurance and things like that. On my properties, even though my tenant's responsible for the building insurance, I actually pay it myself and make him reimburse me for it because I don't want to risk that money's a bit tight the month that comes up for renewal and he forgets about it. And then all of a sudden the kitchen catches the light and it burns down. He goes, oops, sorry, didn't renew the building insurance. So I protect myself that way by having that myself and making them reimburse me for it. But there's about 7 or 8 kind of insurances you can get for commercial. A lot of people get a couple of them based on their risk profile.
Yeah, no, that's the whole way of mitigating risk is so you accept it or you insure against it or you you just don't take that risk at all and move on to something else.
Yeah.
But yeah,
the good thing, Sam, is certain like ones will have lower risk. Like you go buy a warehouse in a warehouse complex and like I mentioned before, the body corporate's got a really healthy admin and sinking fund. There's not a lot that can go wrong. Like it's 3 tilt-up concrete panels and a roller door. Like you can assess that risk pretty well. And as long as you get your right building pest inspections and there's no like settlement issues or anything like that, you are going to be pretty low risk. The one I see the most of when it's the hardest to kind of assess during a building pest inspection is actually water damage because you don't see it. If it's a dry period, you can't see it. If you've got a bit of a faulty roof, like I've had lots of properties where water will start running down the inside and that, and they're always so hard to diagnose. Like they'll go there and think they replace it, but water creeps down certain areas and stuff like that. They're the ones that normally pop up that kind of sting you a little bit with a special levy.
Yeah. You mentioned you've been doing this for obviously a number of years now and you're learning all the time. Any other little tips and tricks that you can rattle off the top of your head that you've been mindful of?
Just do your due diligence. That's probably the biggest one. And we'll probably go into next buying a premise for your tenant. Buying a premise as an owner, And then that's got its own nuances as well.
Yeah. Oh, well, Jared, you've got a couple of little questions I can note, so I'll let you jump in.
Oh, I want to touch on something that we mentioned that was kind of not up for discussion that we chatted about before we hit the record buttons, and that being, you know, a rent investing strategy for businesses in commercial property. Love to hear you hash out for everybody a little bit of a rent investing strategy for businesses in the commercial space.
Yeah, okay. All right. So maybe first I'll go over maybe of like the pros and cons of owning your own premise as a business owner. And then that'll like kind of lead into, okay, what are the negatives will kind of lead into the rent vesting one. So,
and we're talking like pros and cons of like owning it in your SMFS or just owning it
Owning in general. The buying entity, like, well, the pro of buying a self-managed super fund is tax concessions, because you can put money in your super that's got a lower tax rate, and obviously when you get to the end and things like that. So there's a tax one, but I don't make decisions based on tax. For buying the business, the main pros are based on you basically locked into that location. So you don't have to worry about ever being kicked out and scrambling to try to find a new premise or anything like that. So you've got control on that. The other one is, and I kind of just alluded against it, is there are some tax concessions to owning yourself, because Mixter's tax man, and don't hold me to this, anyone, can fudge the numbers a little bit to make it a little bit more attractive for you going there. So they're the two big ones there. You can also do your own thing. You can do fit outs and do the value adds, and no one can tell you otherwise. So like, say you buy that warehouse and you do need more space, you can put a mezzanine there. So you can actually then, you don't have to actually expand at a later date. You've actually got it there internally, which will increase the value as well. And then the other one's obviously it's a capital growth play, as opposed to not buying a premise. You're getting the leverage, you're getting the capital growth, you're getting like an area, like a bigger area. The negatives is also the opposite of that. So you're also locked into that location. So if your business expands and you've got to move on, you're kind of stuck there, then you're leasing the property out and you're in the same position as buying something anyway. So you're a bit more rigid there. The other thing is where your business operates, not necessarily the best location in all of Australia or the best yield. So all of a sudden you're going, I'm buying a bloody big investment, like a huge amount of money into something, and you're not buying the best area that you can. It's kind of like going to buy shares and buying something just because the office tower is near you. Like, it's got nothing to do with it. So you might be losing out on capital growth or sacrificing something there. The other part of it is it might actually be a lower yield to where you'd actually buy. So like a lot of business owners in Sydney and Melbourne and that are buying something like a 4% net yield. And this is going to go into your rent vesting type one. They could go buy an investment in, say, Brisbane or Perth and get a 6.5-7% net yield, and then use that rent to actually rent somewhere, I don't know, 50% larger than what they were currently getting. And then they've got flexibility. They can move on and they actually expand a bit easier, and they're not quite locked into it. So, we only just casually spoken about this, but like rent vesting for commercial is still a thing. So you can still do that as well if you're a business owner. The risk with the business owner as well, and this is the one that I normally talk people out of it if I am having a strategy call with them, is you are putting all your eggs in one basket. You're putting, like, if your business starts struggling, you're then putting your commercial at risk as well. So you're going to lose on two fronts. You're not going to be able to pay your mortgage, and you're going to have a struggling business. At least if you've got your business, the business is struggling, you can wind that up and get out of the lease and obviously pay penalties depending on what the guarantees and stuff are. At least you've still got the other one ticking along. So they're two separate entities, and that reduces the risk that way.
Yeah, I think business owners really need to do like the cost-benefit analysis of like what location would you be buying at for your business versus another location that might be at different capital growth rate, different vacancy rate, different level of risk or not as risky, and then sort of weigh out like what's the opportunity cost between owning the property where you run the business versus like rent investing somewhere else, I guess.
Yeah, the asset type might dictate that as well. So like I said, if you live in an area and you want to open a coffee shop or a medical center or something like that, that's, you're kind of locked in. Owning that's really important because you need the security that you're not going to get kicked out. No one wants to start a business and get kicked out in 5 years' time and be like, well, that was a fun run. And I actually had a client who had that happen to him. We started a cafe, did really well, and he was on, I think it was a 3x3x3 or something like that. And he got to the end, and then the owner of the actual building kicked him out and just started his own cafe because he already had the foot traffic and the name, and completely just wiped him out. Just got rid of all his hard work and profit because they had control of it as well. And so that's an example where buying your own premises is quite important. And he actually said that. He's like, I'll never run a business again where I don't own the property. So you do have scenarios like that.
Yeah, I could see that being really bad for like medical or something like that, right? Like that would really suck not owning that.
Imagine if you're a GP and you've just built a 10-year business of having all the clientele go to that GP clinic. People don't even realize half the time. Like if you change over and put in your, if you're a GP and you own that premise. So that's quite important there. And you need to protect yourself that. One of the things I'll touch on for the listeners is people think that having lots of options is good for their investor. And what I mean by that for on the lease. So having like, oh, this is great. It's got 5x5x5. That people think that's a cool thing. They're like, oh, I've got 15 years worth of lease. It has no advantage to the actual investor because they're still allowed to leave at the end of the 5 years. That advantage is actually for the business owner so they can't get kicked out. So if you're a business owner, you are going to lease somewhere, get as many options as you can. Be like, oh, can I have 50 years worth of options of short periods? And then that way you're at least locked in. Worst case is they increase the rent to market rate, which they're allowed to do, which is fair. But yeah, the options are actually for the tenant, not for the owner.
What would you prefer to see though? Like say 5x5x5 or just as an investor?
As long a lease as possible with good guarantees, of course. So like I'd love a Bunnings on a 30-year lease. Like brilliant. Like so the long is normally easier for finance and it's more secure for you. So you can get as long. But the risk with the businesses, they don't want to sign a really long lease because they don't know where they're going to be kind of thing, especially for industrial. Like, and this is where, like, if you're buying like a little 300 grand warehouse, they're not going to sign a 5 or 10 year lease because they've got no bloody idea where they're going to be in 5 or 10 years. So they sign the shorter ones. The medium and larger size ones, they don't want to be kicked out in 5, 10 years because they rent somewhere with normally around 30-40% expansion. So like if they grow, they still fill the space. They'll sign the longer leases. But to answer your question, a long lease is always attractive for an investor because it's security.
Yeah, but going back to what you were saying before, it was might be the wrong analogy, but the old Robert Kiyosaki, right? Like it's like if you've got this money and you know you go and buy a commercial premises and use that rent to pay for the rent for your business where you want to live, and then you probably make you're making more money on a return basis, right? Because you're buying something that's 7% yielding instead of buying a 3 or 4%. Yielding in Sydney or Melbourne, it's sort of like a bit of a no-brainer, but as always, there's always
hugely.
Yeah, but there are examples where like really well, like Gold Coast and Sunshine Coast we mentioned before are really tight markets with vacancy, some of the tightest in Australia. If you're a tradie and you're paying rent anyway to a business and you're making profit and it's sitting there, like buying a premise is not actually adding that much more risk for you because if you do want to expand, it's still an asset that's got a really tight vacancy rate, a decent yield. You'll fill quite quickly. You'll fill in a month or two. So it kind of makes sense and they've got control of it. So like that in some circumstances makes sense. Could I buy them something better around Australia? Maybe. Is it not bad of an asset? Definitely not. It's a good asset. They're still going to do really well from it long term. So there are circumstances where it makes sense. The harder one's probably if it's a regional business. That's a bit tougher because they're kind of balancing the yield with the risk of it, and then the eggs are in one basket. But the fun part with commercial was talking about in the last 3-4 episodes is there's no right answer. Every asset type, every asset location, configuration, lease terms, types of building, all changes the outcome.
You got something to say, Sam? Question?
No. I'll just say it just all depends on the deal itself and you make that educated decision. But as always, you've got to pull the trigger on something. And
The point I always say to people is just write down the pros and cons of each one. So like part of my strategy call when people are trying to decide like, oh, whether we go residential, whether we go commercial, just write down advantages of commercial. Is it going to stop my investing? Is it going to add to my investing? Residential, is it going to add to my investing? Is it going to take away from my investing? Do I have more leverage with residential? And write it down. And the right answer normally jumps out pretty quick. And if you still don't know, just make sure whatever option you buy the fundamentals. So in 10 years' time, you're still benefiting.
Absolutely. And I think, that process is something we're going to hash out in our next episode. What you like, the key risks you need to know before buying a commercial property. So keep tuned, stay tuned for that one. Steve, thank you for coming on. We've got your book to give away. Where can people go to get that?
Go to policyproperty.com and use code word property pals and you get it for free. I'll send it probably normally within a day or two it gets to you.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll put that in the show notes. Property Pals is there's a few P's in there, isn't there, Jared? But
Policy Property Property Pals.
Yeah. Maybe we could. That's obviously the only reason why we got you on the pod, mate, because we love P's.
There's another one, podcast. This is we're the five P's, the Policy Property Property Pals podcast.
Yeah. Please, mate, you should be an actor with that.
The synergies. Yeah, thanks for coming on, Steve. We really appreciate everybody listening. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next one.
Awesome, guys. Thank you.